This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Intro Adventures.
A Saracen Vampire.
The Disapproving Father.
And Chess Magic.
Autumn, time for gathering the harvest and utter carnage in the garden.
Wait, what was that last one?
You heard me, Robin. It's time for some good old-fashioned garden warfare. Vicious Gardens is the new card game where you combine the joy of horticulture with the thrill of being a total jerk.
Okay, hold on. I thought we were talking about gardening.
We are, because in Vicious Gardens, you're not just planting petunias, my friend. You're sabotaging others in a cutthroat cultivation competition.
Okay, that sounds a bit intense for my usual pansies and peonies.
Oh, this is way beyond pansies, my friend. This is a battle for garden domination. You gotta sabotage your opponents, steal their plants, and choke out their prize-winning produce.
So it's a strategy game, but with plants?
You got it, because the best gardeners are willing to get their hands dirty.
Okay, I'm strangely into this. Where can I join in the horticultural havoc?
Vicious Gardens is open for pre-orders now. Reserve yours at atlas-games.com, then prepare for the meanest, greenest garden melee ever. The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the gaming hut. And today, the welcome is the point, because we are going to discuss the intro adventure. Often, of course, you have your brand new role-playing game that you're so excited to play, and you turn to the back of the book, and hopefully, he says... minotaurally, there is an introductory adventure in the back that gives an idea of what the game designer thinks you're supposed to do with it, and also, ideally, gives you a doorway into a new campaign, and absolutely gives you something to do the night you bought the game, rather than have to prep a whole new adventure and take time and maybe lose that new game smell in the interim. So, Robin, the nature of the intro adventure, I've now introduced the problem. Why don't you adventure it?
Well, and you've introduced it in a way that I think is somewhat optimistic. I think you're assuming an ideal situation, which certainly in the past, you quite often will see sort of a vestigial adventure in the core book that doesn't really represent what the whole experience is and doesn't necessarily work as your first experience with this game. I think one style of intro adventure that I think is less common now, but I might be proven wrong, is the tutorial that is basically sort of a short demo that is trying to, in order, kind of introduce players to the rule system and how it works. And it's more focused on teaching the mechanics than necessarily being a representative sample of what an adventure in this game system feels like. If we do, in fact, see less of that today, I think part of that is because rule systems, the big complicated games, have existed long enough that they have other ways of introducing their rules to people. And it's less necessary for more streamlined games that tend to be sort of the norm today, where we're dropping complexity because people have less time to learn new systems. Because a adventure in which you, in sequence, encounter the simplest resolution mechanic, and then the medium resolution mechanic, and then a somewhat more complex resolution mechanic, and then a fight, is basically, that's the ideal version of no game, right?
Right, yeah. But I think that we do still see that tutorial. First of all, a lot of the reason we don't see it is because people have gotten better at including examples of play, by and large, in games where there's complexity. So hopefully it's been explained already. But I also think that it is migrated to the starter box. That the adventure in the starter box, there's often a tutorial, and then sometimes there's a more regular adventure as well. The tutorial is the sort of play this to get up to speed with the game, and then there is the more regular sort of, you know, example or introduction type adventure, introduction into the story or the game world, rather than just introduction to how does archery work again or whatever.
Right. And I think the issue there is that, like, if you see a super vestigial version of an adventure in the back of a big fat rules book, that's because the rules book squeezed out the adventure. You don't have the space
word count
to put it in there. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that a thing that doesn't really represent you is worse than nothing. And that ideally, if you can't do that, have an adventure book that comes out alongside the core book that people can have.
Right.
But you're absolutely right to suggest that as we increasingly try to deal with the difficulties of onboarding people into complicated games, the starter box has become more of a thing. And it interests me to see the different approaches that people take with starter boxes, because some of them are more interested in conveying the vibe of the game to the extent of sometimes like having a solo game as part of a starter box, which is teaching the GM what the vibe is and sort of selling the property to people, but of course is largely unrelated to what a game that you will run for other players at the table would be. So what would you say, given all of these different options, if you get to choose, what do you want to do in terms of giving people an intro adventure?
Well, I've written 3 introductory adventures for Gumshoe products. I wrote an introductory adventure for the Lord of the Rings box set for the Lord of the Rings game from Decipher, which was a whole different universe. That was much more of a teach GMs how to play type thing. It wasn't a solo, but it was very much very dependent on here are some random tables to constrain your choices. Here is a way to put out a combat. Here is a way to put out a thing. But of the 3 things that I've done for Gumshoe games, I think that we can both agree that Kingsbury Horror is a terrific adventure in the sense that it shows what the system can do and what games you can play with it, but it is not very introductory because it sort of throws players into the Ocean of Clues style to a very large degree. It's very atmospheric and thematic. Things happen for no reason because it's, you know, about chaos. And so that is, I suppose, not the most introductory of introductory adventures. And then maybe as a reaction against that, my introductory adventure for Knights Black Agents, Sentries, is very much a, here is how a investigation works. Here is a way to do a heist. Here is a way to survive a hit. Here is a way to do an investigation. These are 3 beats of this story. This will open up a whole Knights Black Agents campaign if you play it and if you want to do that. And that was very much sort of, you know, going the other direction from the adventure I did in Trail. And then I guess the Operation Aladdin's Cave in Fall of Delta Green is sort of is between those as more of a template or an example. This is what an op looks like. Here you go. But it's less concerned with opening up the Delta Green world to the players on the assumption that that's what the whole Delta Green chapter has done already. And the assumption, I guess, is that because the sort of the story is easier to figure out what kind of adventures you might have. And also because I think the, you know, constructing adventures part's a little tighter. I didn't feel it as necessary to handhold the player as much as I did in Knights Black Agents. I think of the 3, I'm still fondest of Sentries as the model, but it's, you know, uncoincidentally also the longest of the 3 by a good bit. And so therefore, you know, if you're going to do that one right, you do have to make sure that the game book doesn't crowd it out, as you said.
And partly because Gumshoe and other systems I've worked on like Feng Shui are relatively simple compared to, say, GURPS or Champions or an F20 game, although F20 handled the simplicity different and what an adventure looks like can be shorter because you can just do, you know, 6 rooms in a dungeon and you're good to go. But in terms of a more script-like scenario, I'm definitely aiming for something that feels like a template because it is not only there to teach players how to play the system and GMs what the general vibe of the game is, but to act as a model, a template for the GM to look at and go, oh, and the adventure that I create should be like this. It should follow this structure. It should have these basic elements in it. And another note that I would give to others planning to do this is for this purpose, it's like writing the pilot episode of a television series. And so you do not want to overthink what you're presenting to people. You want to present the most absolutely elemental version of this sort of adventure. And so if it has, for its genre, the giantest cliche in it, that's actually good.
Yeah.
Because you're doing the absolute baseline thing. So if you're doing, you know, a cult investigation and there's a ritual where they're trying to summon a monster at the end, you might be thinking, well, that's kind of old hat. That's too on the nose. There's no way to be too on the nose with an introductory adventure.
Right.
Do the absolute, simple, most obvious thing, because not only will that be the easiest for you to construct, but it'll be the easiest for the GM and the players to get a handle on of this is the baseline from which we will later riff. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to release a campaign book that is entirely occult rituals at the end, or your space opera is not going to have every episode have the players logic a super intelligent computer into self-destructing. But for the first one, that's good. And so you absolutely should not overthink, have the simplest possible version of what it is that you're doing.
Yeah. And that I think is easier said than done in some genres and some stories. Like, for example, you say the standard F20 dungeon is dirt simple to present a vampire adventure. First of all, there is no modal vampire adventure, because the nature of a vampire campaign when you started out, or should I say chronicle, when you started out, could be all over the map. I mean, you could be doing high intrigue and politics. You could be grimy street life. You could be, we're cleaning up the streets by eating heroin dealers. There's a million ways you can do vampire, because vampire is meant to sort of be a vampiric window on all of, you know, the urban underbelly, or all of the dark side of humanity. And so therefore, the intro adventure is almost impossible in a game like that. So what would be your advice for whatever lucky fellow is doing a intro adventure for either Vampire, you know, 6th or 7th edition or whatever, or another game that is like that, that does not have a paradigmatic adventure, even though its core activity, you know, still exists? The core activity in Vampires is, you know, resist your beast. But that's not what the adventure is.
So is a core activity in Vampire resist your beast, which is something that you need to do in order to do other things, or is it engage in vampire intrigue?
Right.
Because if it's the second one, I think there is a default version of Vampire, which is there's a big political shape coming in the world of vampires, and you who may be feeding on drug dealers, or you may be Vegas high rollers, or you may be any of these other campaign concepts, every so often something happens in your city that everybody's got to show up for and do something. So I would say the obvious intro adventure for Vampire is a vampire conclave at which you are expected to show up and survive.
Right. Yeah. And that, of course, is another very difficult kind of an adventure to write and to run. So I guess that's another sort of a question is, what if your, I don't want to say core activity, but what if your universal activity is something that is difficult to run as an introductory part of a chronicle, even though, you know, it might or might not be particularly hard for someone who's sunk their teeth into the game and the material already. Because with a conclave, there's a lot of backstory that the GM has to master to make it run correctly. And that's a tough lift. And it's an even tougher lift. You have to jam it into the back of a core book.
Right. So the trick there, I think, is to find a window into that, that again, I think the other useful question is, what is the pilot episode of a vampire TV show that is not doing a, you know, weird riff on the game, but is the absolute thing that most people do? Or what is the typical vampire LARP would be another great question, right? And how to turn that into something. So you might narrow the focus in that, you know, you are way outside the corridors of power when it comes to vampires in your city, but you've got to go in and get one piece of information, right? You have one simple thing to do at this conclave. You're not going to be electing one of your members the royal throne for your city. You're not going to be determining who's going to be in charge, but you have to be there and show up and, you know, avoid being noticed and do this one simple thing through which you will then meet all of the power players and then start to think of this in terms of, you know, here's the exposition that you would need, say, as viewers to understand and get into this show. And I will kind of say that there must be a default vampire experience in order for that game to be as big and exciting as it is. And I would bet that although it has many different options, that the variation between what most people are doing in their games is probably not so infinite that you cannot have a scenario that funnels people into that or provides them an introduction. And so to think of this as, here's your intro of all these guys to vampire politics in your series, and you've got a simple goal, and then you can take that away. So rather than have a bunch of big info dumps, is to construct the scenes so that, you know, you encounter a number of the big players, you get a lay of the land, and you do something, and then you get out.
It suddenly occurs to me that I ran a intro con scenario for Vampire at, you know, Gen Con before the game came out while we were developing it. And I think I've come up with another, I don't know if it's a universal thing, but it's the prince gives you an annoying order. And that is sort of a standard vampire experience, regardless of what you're supposed to be doing. And in this case, there was a mortal with very valuable blood. It gave better powers. It had a magic quality to the blood, and they'd gotten away from whoever was keeping them. And there had been spotted in your domain, in your turf. And since every coterie is expected to have a turf that they protect, because that's part of their, or own, rather, protect is not the word, predate upon, that it's your responsibility to grab that valuable human and return them to their owner, Toot Sweet, thank you very much. And then you, the vampires, got to say, do we want to do that? Do we want to keep the valuable human for ourselves? Do we want to drink them dry and hide the body and pretend that we never saw them? And that sets up the sort of political question while also being a pretty straightforward hunt this guy scenario. And, you know, then there's like a quaestor or whoever, I forget. There was a bad guy vampire that was a sheriff, is what they're called, that was coming in to, you know, track the person because they did not trust you, in fact. And so you had to, you know, once you made your decision, you had to deal with this stronger vampire in a way that would not put you on the outs with their boss or with the prince. And that gave you another little political decision making. But if you wanted it to, it could be a fight scene. And I think thinking about it, you know, or remembering what I did to do a intro vampire, that might be a sort of, it's not that exact experience doesn't happen, but finding a human to drink, that does happen in everyone. There is a politically untouchable vampire who is annoying you. That happens in every vampire scenario. And there is a mid-level vampire who you can plot against or beat up upon, maybe, if you do it right. And I think that's in most vampire scenarios. So, yeah, I guess it's not so much there is a template scenario, but there are template elements that you can combine into a, what do you want to say, a not overthought vampire adventure.
Right. If there's a game, if there's something about your core activity that can involve a MacGuffin, do a MacGuffin. A thing that they have to get in order to make the plot work. And sometimes the thing they have to get is not an object, but it's the answer to a question, which covers all of the Gumshoe games, covers all the mysteries. And I think that sort of helps you on the way to having a very simple spine that you can then arrange all of the core elements of your game around. Well, I think we've introduced the podcast well, and having talked about vampires, it's time to listen to a commercial and then have another segment, which couldn't possibly also be about vampires.
That would be unlikely in the extreme. Moving drama.
Hilarious comedy.
And you are the sole protagonist.
Page Turners is my game of personal storytelling for one player and one GM.
Coming in February from Pelgrane Press.
Longtime listeners know Hillfolk, my game of dramatic group play.
Winner of the coveted Diana Jones Award.
Page Turner shifts its dynamic down to the intimate scale of a single main character whose fiction you weave on the fly with one other creator.
Shockingly simple rules keep the focus on emotional interaction.
Extensive guidance helps you shape satisfying outcomes.
Writers Sarah Sam Saltiel, Wade Rocket, and Ruth Tillman join Robin in presenting 11 scenarios spanning a wealth of genres and tones.
Scenarios include
Jazz Age Ambition and Glamour,
a childhood haunted by strife, and a shadowy being.
Deceit and survival on the spaceship Earth again.
A stay in Bath takes an unexpected turn in the Austin-inspired Entreaty and Entanglement.
The screwball 30s hijinks of Loose Screws.
The Shakespearean comedy of Love's Loyal Laborers.
A love triangle unfolding from the turbulent 60s to the troubled 20-teens.
Behind the music drama in the LA punk scene.
The arrival of a telepathic stranger on a spacebound way station.
Tragic love between a vampire and a mortal.
And an epic multi-generational saga of artificial beings attempting to build a civilization in the tradition of that extinct species, Homo sapiens.
Gorgeously laid out and illustrated by graphic superstar Jen McCleary.
Whoever you want to be, wherever your imagination takes you.
Whether your journey leads to Union Doom or something harder to define.
Page Turners unleashes your story in new and unexpected ways.
It's time once more for that most terrifying hut, the one with ghosties and ghoulies and chains rattling, because it's the Horror Hut, kiddies. And this time around, we're going to look at an incident in history. Usually, when I lay in the new segments for the next week's episode, which I do on the same day that we record the episode, I'll put them in there, and then a week later, your research will appear in the Google Doc when I get up in the morning on Tuesday. But this time around, I had no sooner added this to the Google Doc when I saw you typing in the research, so you clearly know about this guy. Let's proceed from here. So, in 378, the Visigoths were turned back from the gates of Constantinople when a loincloth-wearing Saracen warrior leapt upon a Visigoth counterpart, slit his throat, and drank his spurting blood. Who was this vampire and what else did he do, Ken?
And you say that I knew this guy, and the reason I responded so rapidly is that I did not know this guy. If I know the thing, then I'm just lay back and say, I'll do it Sunday night. That'll be fun.
You got a whole week to do it. But if it's a wild card, you gotta hit the books immediately.
But this one was one where I said, all right, obviously this is something from some ill-edited Peter Haining compilation, and I'm going to have to dig down and find the real...
Thoroughly debunk it.
Classical story. Thoroughly debunk it. Let Robin down easy, and then we'll all play pretend. But no, Robin, much to my delight, the absolute solid gold historian of late antiquity, Ammianus, has this story in his chronicle. This is from Ammianus 3116, book 31. Go ahead, look it up your own self. And here is what Ammianus says. One of their number, a Saracen with long hair and naked except for a loincloth, uttering hoarse and dismal cries, with drawn dagger rushed into the thick of the Gothic army, and after killing a man, applied his lips to the throat and sucked the blood that poured out. The barbarians, terrified by this strange and monstrous sight, after that did not show their usual self-confidence. That is Ammianus, and he's contemporary to the time he's writing about. The other chronicler of that era is a guy named Zosimus, who also mentions the siege but does not mention the Saracen vampire. And Zosimus says that the siege took place before the Battle of Adrianople. Most military historians go with Ammianus and say that it took place after the Battle of Adrianople. The Battle of Adrianople, also in 378, is when the Emperor Valens takes the whole Byzantine army, or East Roman army as it was then, out to fight the Visigoths and is killed with much of his army. And the notion being that the Visigoths then moved on to besiege Constantinople. That makes military and strategic sense. So, leaving the question of Zosimus aside, now we say, what are Saracens doing in Constantinople? And it turns out, first of all, Saracen is not just a mean thing that Crusaders called the Arabs. The Saracens were a tribe of Arabs from this time. And at this time, they were, in fact, very Christian Arabs. And their queen was a lady named Mavia, according to the Roman sources, and probably Mawia, according to what the language would have been. And she was the queen of the Tanukids, is the other name for this tribe of Arabs. And they were so Christian that they fought a religious revolt against the Emperor Valens because they wanted a Catholic bishop instead of an Eastern bishop. They wanted one who was true to the rites of Rome, not the rites of Constantinople. And they won their rebellion. They basically conquered all of Syria and much of the Holy Land, and Valens had to give in, and he gave them their own bishop, and then they became federati of the emperor, which meant they sent troops to Constantinople to defend it as part of the peace treaty. And her daughter, as a part of the peace treaty, was married. Mawia's daughter was married to Valens's cavalry general Victor, who I don't know if he died at Adrianople or not. He disappears from the history books pretty soon. But she was ruling from modern Aleppo. Her base was east of Aleppo in the desert and the mountains, but she ruled from Aleppo while she was ruling because she was, as I mentioned, super impressive. So that's the Saracens that had been sent out to serve in Constantinople. And the sort of going theory by the only academic article on these Saracens that I was able to find is that they may have served as part of the bodyguard of the Empress Domnica, who was the one who commanded the defense of the city, the emperor being, remember, killed at Adrianople. And speaking of people who we don't know if they died, there's no record of Domnica dying. So if she's got a vampire bodyguard, I think you can write the paranormal romance book yourself right there. So the Tanukids continue to be Christians in Syria, which is increasingly difficult to hold on to. And right around 800 AD, they march to Baghdad to serve the Caliph Harun al-Rashid. And he says, "Oh, you guys are Christians?" And they said, "Yes, we are, oh, most rightly guided Caliph." And he has them all executed. And so they say, "Well, we're not being Christians anymore." So they became the Druze. They converted to Druze religion, and they became the Buturid clan, and they moved to Mount Lebanon, and they basically took over Mount Lebanon. And whoever owned Beirut was their buddy because they got to, you know, sell produce to the city and control the approaches to the city. And so finally, their stranglehold over Beirut has angered their fellow sectarians enough that a fellow named Alam al-Din, who was a Druze chieftain of a rival clan, massacred them to the last man in 1633. So if you assume that the vampire Saracen and his immortal bride Domnica stayed with their family, then probably they got massacred in 1633, or they had to escape and go somewhere else. And Robin, you've turned a possible location of the somewhere else up in your own research.
Right. So there's the connection between Constantinople, later Istanbul, and vampires is an interesting one, because when they invade the Balkans, the story is that they find vampires there and that the vampires come back to Turkey. But there might be some question there if there are bloodsuckers around the area and fighting battles in front of Constantinople in the 4th century. They might have been there for a while, and perhaps the Ottomans took them with them to the Balkans and populated the Balkans. So there's Suleiman the Great. His cleric issues a number of fatwas against vampires, which are interesting because you've got to, what you do to kill a vampire, you first have to determine whether the vampire was Muslim or not. Because if they're an infidel, you have more options in dealing with the corpse than you do if he's a Muslim. So that's an interesting twist on that. But the 17th century Turkish writer Evliya Çelebi goes to the Balkans and he finds vampire problems big time there, to the extent that there's a profession of vampire hunter where you can hire pros to go to the graveyard, figure out which of them has a vampire in it, which of the graves, and then they deal with it. And so there's all sorts of places where our nameless Saracen warrior could have gone. He could have migrated into the Balkans and met Vlad the Impaler. He could have introduced him to vampirism, or he could have stuck around in the Middle East and be there today, because, of course, Aleppo is no stranger to horror and warfare, even in our current day. And so in a Knights Black Agents campaign, Ken, what has this guy and possibly Domnica, what are they up to now, and why will the player characters run into them?
I think it is, I mean, obviously you can make Domnica sort of your Lilith figure, the third force. She is a queen of vampires. She's been a queen since the 4th century, as you say. She's not going to deal with some jumped up pretender like Elizabeth Bathory. She's not going to have any great respect for some, you know, erstwhile Dacian like Dracula. She's going to think that, you know, only her and the proper Byzantine lineage are suited to rule the world. So that's sort of the standard answer. And there's nothing wrong with the standard answer, as we discussed earlier. I think another great possibility is that Domnica and her nameless Saracen bodyguard boyfriend have, as you say, been ground zero for vampirism all over the Middle East. They're trying to settle down and, you know, stay under the radar, but gosh darn it, history keeps happening to them. You know, Harun al-Rashid goes after her boyfriend's tribe. She, of course, is going to have her own opinions on, you know, the rise of Justinian and Theodora to the imperial throne. So perhaps they're still in Istanbul as the secret rulers of the city. They rule the Istanbul underground, making Istanbul sort of an open city for vampires that no matter which faction of the war you're on, you can, as long as you pay tribute to Domnica, then you can hang out in Istanbul for as long as you like. The other possibility is that what we have as her, you know, her bodyguard having, you know, won the siege of Constantinople is now an immortal warrior vampire. And he has moved from battle to battle to battle. And so every so often, you know, as you're going through your reports, you see something from an old NKVD file about the Battle of Stalingrad and a guy who was drinking blood from the corpses of the Germans. And they said, well, he's drinking the Germans. We probably shouldn't disturb him too much. And that will be your lead for this nameless vampire warrior. And obviously the immortal warrior, you know, Wolverine or Highlander or anything else, that's its own trope. And I think that guy becomes more fun as a incredibly powerful wandering monster who just sort of shows up in your campaign. He's drawn to the battlefield. Maybe that's his curse, or maybe that's just how he gets excited in the, you know, wakes up in the evening to go to another battlefield. That's what he likes.
It could be like he's the old ball player trying to relive his glory days, right?
Right.
His greatest moment ever was that moment when he turned the tide at Constantinople. So he's looking for other battles to change the direction of, and he doesn't care anymore what the battle's about, who's fighting. He just wants to show up and do that thing again.
And terrify everybody.
Yeah. Now, it means he's got lousy OPSEC because he's doing vampire stuff in front of everybody's eyes. But, you know, when people come at him, he just rips them to shreds. He's not too concerned about that so far.
Yeah, and he could show up on, like, drone footage from Ukraine, for example. And you're like, what? What's that guy doing? Oh, my God. And then you go in and investigate, and that's his story. He's, you know, he's the Bull Durham of vampires, just wandering from game to game.
Right. And because he's doing that, you may be assigned to point him in the direction of the enemy you want him to fight, right? That your initial job can be, you know, hey, get this guy and point him in the direction that the CIA wants him pointed. And that's easy for the guys in the back office to say, but you've got to deal with him, right? You've got to drive the semi-truck that has his coffin in the back. And he's turns out to be, like a lot of freelancers, somewhat truculent.
this could be, you know, Edom's alternative to Dracula. They could have this guy, or as you say, the CIA's Fine Forever vampire program is like, well, the British have Dracula, but we have an even older, cooler vampire, the immortal warrior. And we just have to sort of, you know, pay his transport and make sure that he goes to a really cool battle. And then sort of the job of the GM can look for weirdly one-sided wins in recent military history and say, I'll bet he was there. And then that gives you your back trace. So maybe he was at the Conoco gas fields battle that obliterated Wagner in Syria, or maybe he was at Hostomel when the VDV were turned back from the airborne landings in Kiev at the beginning of the invasion. And that's just what he was doing, is he's wherever there was a, you know, there's no reason these guys should have lost. Well, this is the guy who made them lost. So that's his footprint, and you can figure out what he's doing. And maybe your assignment is to find him so that you can recruit him for Fine Forever or Edom or whoever else. And then the question is, what can you offer this guy who's immortal and unkillable and basically just needs carnage to be happy?
And where are we going to find him? The worst war zone currently available. Yeah.
That's the worst part, is you have to, you know, go to the Congo or somewhere and dig him out of some horrendous child soldier grave.
Well, now that we've brought him up to date, from the annals of the 4th century to today. It's time for us to close up this horror hut, make sure there's some nails to nail the coffin lid shut, not that that'll help with this guy, and move on into a more salubrious, more literary hut on the other side of this here commercial. In the spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Make your dad proud by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Mo Lane,
Michael Bowman,
Michael Harrison,
Michael Manival,
and Monster Talk.
The Harlequin mask, the Columbine dress, the smiley face mask, the frowny face mask, all hang on the side of one of the most dramatic of huts, the stock character hut. And when we enter the stock character hut today, we are met by a disapproving father, just as in every script written in the last 50 years. But despite being a horrendous and tiresome writer's crutch, it can also be fun in your game. But for that, we have to sort of dig back to the sort of the structural role of the disapproving father, which, as you say, is mostly there to interfere with a marriage. He's the guy that doesn't want you to marry his daughter fundamentally, and then sort of expands from that to all levels of problem patriarch. And I found the very first one, and then Robin, you found all the other ones. So I'm going to say we begin with King Saul, who disapproves of David as a suitor for his daughter, Michal. And he says, okay, David, you can marry my daughter. You just have to go collect 1,000 foreskins from the Philistines. And this is, you know, the way you get rid of an annoying suitor back in the 10th century BC in, you know, hillfolk times. But guess what? David has got a sharp, sharp knife and comes back and marries Michal. So,
right. And that's the, that sets the pattern right there, because the disapproving father in this archetypal version, and we'll get to variants in a while, is an enforcer of class and also wealth barriers. So David, he's a scruffy nobody from the middle of nowhere. Doesn't matter what his inherent qualities are. King Saul is a king, and this guy is not good enough. And to prove he's good enough, he has to go and make a whole bunch of war, because that's what you do to achieve social mobility in that situation. Mm-hmm. And so this is a very, very old pattern. The Greek plays of Menander from the 4th century BCE foreshadow it somewhat, but it's Terence in the 2nd century in Rome who really crystallizes this with his comedies. So an archetypal one of his comedies is called Andrea, or The Woman from Andros, which is a reboot of Menander's The Girl from Samos.
And you can imagine the audience is saying, I don't know why they had to change the island. It was perfectly good in the original.
Right, yeah. And not only is this the early example of a disapproving father, but it's the early example of the Canadian girlfriend, because the love interest is offstage throughout the entire play. So in Terence's Andrea, the father, Simo, blocks his son Pamphilus's marriage to the offstage girl he loves and has impregnated in favor of one he has arranged, the daughter of a father's friend. So it's the traditional patriarchal arrangement where the father decides who you marry. The father decides that in order to bolster his own business interests, his own alliances. And so it's love versus practicality. And it is the young generation up against the older entrenched patriarchy. And Terence loves this device. He uses it in The Mother-in-Law, The Brothers, and in Formio. And of course, the Greek and also Roman playwrights greatly influence Shakespeare. And we find various versions of this throughout Shakespeare. So let's get to some texts that people might actually know, as opposed to the now never performed Terence comedies. So Prospero tests Ferdinand's love for Miranda. Due to the role of gamesmanship in Shakespeare, sometimes, as in this case, Prospero isn't so much, you know, disapproving, is just wanting to make, you know, kick the tires a bit on this potential son-in-law. So he makes
but he also summons gods to demonstrate to Ferdinand that he'd better not have sex before marriage. So
yes,
there's a little of the I have a shotgun part of the disapproving father in Prospero.
Yes, he's very patriarchal there. In Midsummer Night's Dream, which has a number of different couples who are separated by various obstacles, including an existing couple that has come apart and must reconcile, Aegeus commands his daughter Hermia to marry Demetrius instead of her love Lysander. So that's an exact parallel of the woman from Andros. In fact, he's the harshest of the disapproving fathers in Shakespeare. He says that he not only has a right to send her to a convent if she doesn't marry the right guy, he could just kill her. So he's a really harsh version of the disapproving father. The Merchant of Venice has two disapproving fathers. One of them is dead already in a trope that we're going to return to again and again, is the escaping the shadow of the dead or absent father. That's Portia's father, of course, is left behind the test of the three caskets, and you have to solve this. Turns out to be kind of simple moral riddle, and
right, yeah.
pick the right one. It's the same riddle shows up in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Pick the crummy packaging is the answer there. But also Shylock, who is present in the play, obviously, and his daughter's elopement is one of the things that drives his motivation for revenge. Romeo and Juliet is sort of an inversion of the comedy format, where comedies contrive toward union and a marriage, and this is about a marriage that can't happen, that is impossible, and turns to tragedy. And in order to accomplish that, Shakespeare gives us two sets of disapproving parents, led by Lords Capulet and Montague. And then we have an interesting flip of the pattern in King Lear, where the disapproving father becomes his own obstacle, that he misguidedly, of course, right at the beginning, withholds his love from the daughter he should be approving of, and gives his approval to the daughters who don't deserve it. And then he winds up, that sort of kicks off his spiral into hell, into tragedy.
And with Lear, you leave behind the question of, do we approve of marriage, and get into, do we approve of you part, right? Because, you know, he is not mad about Cordelia going off and getting married. He's just mad that she doesn't love him best. And so that's the sort of, we're not, you know, as you say, standing athwart society's bulwarks. In this case, we're just being sort of toxic and annoying in a less immediately socio-political way.
Right. And arguably, that's sort of the richer thing, right? The other conflict is a conflict that is designed to be resolved and to create union.
Right.
This is something that might remind people of their own lives and their own relationships with different people in it. And so Lear typifies a subset of the disapproving father, which is the wild father who has to be tamed. And we continue to see that, for example, in the Royal Tenenbaums. The Royal Tenenbaum, the Gene Hackman character, is attempting to assert patriarchal authority, but actually he's an agent of chaos who comes in and brings necessary turbulence and healing confusion to a family that doesn't want him and keeps trying to cast him back out. And this is a formula that Wes Anderson returns to again in the Phoenician Scheme. The Benicio del Toro character is another example of the wild father who must be tamed. In Meet the Fockers, Jack Burns, played by Robert De Niro, is both. He is, as an ex-CIA guy, and, you know, he's extremely right-coded, and therefore he is both an avatar of conventional patriarchal traditional values, but also because he takes it so far over the top, he becomes the wild father who must be tamed, which is, I think, a really fun combination of those tropes and an illustration of something extremely popular today that, you know, that revolves around that thing that, you know, was being done in Roman theater. A much more modest version of that is George Banks, the Steve Martin character in Father of the Bride, where he's the exasperated, mildly disapproving father who, you know, he's going to miss his daughter because she'll be going off and getting married. So that is, he's come pre-tamed. But again, he's the protagonist, and the marriage of the daughter makes him cranky in a nice sort of fun, comfy sort of way. And that was the same dynamic for the Spencer Tracy character in the 1950 original. Austin does not really revolve as much as you might assume around disapproving fathers. So Mr. Bennett, for example, in Pride and Prejudice is sort of, he's kind of a passive, kind of wise ass disapproving father. And so he's less an obstacle because men no longer have the power to drive narrative in the world of Jane Austen, but just sort of someone who's dropping wry insults along the way. And a little later on with My Man Godfrey in the screwball comedy era, you get the comic disapprover who, again, sort of reverses the formula a bit in that he's the only sane character in the nutty family in My Man Godfrey. And he has a similar role in Lubitsch's Heaven Can Wait. And in The Lady Eve, he does a more classic version of the character where he's the classic class-enforcing snob father who wants to keep the con artist Barbara Stanwyck away from the wholesome knob Henry Fonda. And Walter Connolly plays a very similar role in It Happened One Night. So this is a character who goes all through screwball comedy, although very often in screwball comedy, you get another interesting phenomenon, the deflection of the patriarchal figure, where you see father figures, you see like uncles or rich aunts or just a domineering social circle or like the family lawyer start to stand in for the father character, I think because it is considered too shocking and harsh to have a daughter-father conflict or a son-father conflict. And so these things are, in order to keep everything light and funny, the structural role of the disapproving father is handed to a father surrogate.
And also humiliating that surrogate is funnier than humiliating your father. So since a lot of it has to turn on them being proven wrong, often in an embarrassing social circumstance, it's easier and more fun to do that to the lawyer or the uncle than to do it to your actual dad, which would be
right.
Mean.
Because having those conflicts can be quite harrowing, as we see when we go into the more serious conflict with the dysfunctional dad. So in Sam Shepard's Buried Child, the character Dodge, sort of the avatar of family alcoholism and failure that the son characters kick against but are already too warped to do anything about. In the Terrence Malick film Badlands, Holly's father, played by Warren Oates, is the hard, tough father who's trying to keep Kit, the Martin Sheen character, away from her, and that's what precipitates their crime spree. Or you see the disapproving father sort of specifically about the negative masculinity of being a father. So the avatar of that is Robert Duvall as Bull Meacham in The Great Santini. And in Eugene O'Neill's play, A Long Day's Journey Into Night, James Tyrone is sort of the avatar of the, again, the sort of failed figure who is, his failures are sort of dripping down into the younger generation. And they need to sort of kick against them or survive or escape in order to try and remain whole.
And once you get into just sort of generically awful fathers, then we have a whole litany of them. Like I say, not just the sort of you know, tired cliches, but ones that sort of helped make the archetype that the tired cliche depends on. So not just Darth Vader, but you've got Noah Cross in Chinatown, the worst dad imaginable in film. And that, you know, sort of sets the pattern because it's playing off that old sort of notion of 30s social class. It resonates really well, even with the screwball comedies that dance away from it in almost every aspect that they can. But this is the noir approach to which you tear the comforting lies of society off the horrible truth. And no one has torn a more comforting lie off a more horrible truth than in Chinatown with John Huston as Noah Cross.
Right. And to go to horror for a second, Victor Frankenstein, of course, is also one of literature's worst dads.
Yes.
And that it's from his point of view, but he is definitely the father as villain. And we also have bad dads or toxic patriarchs as anti-heroes. So recent examples would include Tony Soprano in The Sopranos and Logan Roy in Succession. I call them anti-heroes in this case because they're, first of all, the main characters, and so they're not, they are constantly blocking other people in their families, but also at the same time that we see all of the destruction, emotional or literal in the case of Tony, that they're wreaking, we also kind of vicariously enjoy their power and kind of like it when they put down certain family members, at least in the case of Logan Roy in particular, because they are also all weasels.
And of course, that's the, you know, classic nighttime soap architecture, going back to J.R. Ewing in Dallas. As you know, he was not the first, but he was one of the first, you know, sort of gigantic cultural phenomenon, toxic dads who you still love to hate. And that set a pattern for 35 years of narrative television that even the golden age has not particularly tried to extract itself from.
And the reason you see this all of the time and have so many variations is it's extremely relatable, right? That we don't all have a wastrel in our lives. We don't all have a stuffed shirt, but most people have either fathers or the shadow of an absent father. You're going to have one or the other. Mm-hmm. And so in Page Turners, the game of dramatic interaction for one player and one GM, now available, we, of course, touch on the issues of fatherhood and having supporting characters that the protagonist player interacts with who have fatherly or literally or otherwise relationships with you. So in The Beacon, which is the sort of F. Scott Fitzgerald pastiche that we've talked about a bit, that has the escaping the shadow of an absent father. So Steve Stark, the male protagonist, who you can choose, he's trying to escape the shadow of his father's failures. Or Delia Stark, in their backstory, they eloped despite her father's disapproval. And again, that uses the classic, he was, you know, a rich guy from a high society. Steve is a nobody. They got married anyway. So that's, you know, touching on that classic, very useful trope. And the rich neighbor, Huck Stanton, can become a sort of surrogate father to either of them as part of their, you know, recapitulating these patterns. In Sam Saltiel's Addison's Shadow, which is sort of a child-focused domestic drama with a supernatural element, her dad, Cliff, Addison's dad, is the sort of defeated, sometimes kind of mean dad that you sort of harkens back to O'Neill or Shepherd. In my Shakespearean pastiche, Love's Loyal Laborers, of course I had to get a forbidding father in there. So there's Lord Bentival, who's the to the male romantic lead, who you as either his servant or the servant of his beloved, you're trying to maneuver into a marriage. But one of the obstacles is this commanding father whose authority is kind of slipping. And so even though you're not the son or daughter in this scenario, he's still your obstacle in getting in the way of the marriage that you're attempting to make happen. And in Wade Rockett's True Rock Stories, Lizzie Lyer, again, she is escaping the shadow of her tyrannical father, and that drives a lot of the protagonist's behavior and is part of the backstory. So the reason we see this in fiction all the time, going all the way back to the Bible and having many, many examples still today, is that it's a rich, simple, relatable relationship and dynamic that you can continue to mine for drama again and again.
And once we have started mining for drama again and again, it's important that we not overexert ourselves, but instead we take a little break to listen to a commercial, and then maybe head into another hut.
The British are coming!
To the American South and the lands over the mountains in Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
Ken and Robin listeners can download a free PDF copy of the core rules from nationsandcannons.com using code KenRobin.
And educators can get a physical copy for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West, with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
Salvage the rebels' foreign alliances in Haiti and Spanish New Orleans.
Recover a mysterious map from Daniel Boone.
Sail into the heart of darkness, investigating George Rogers Clark's strange conquest of Vincennes.
Escape when all seems lost at Savannah and Charleston.
Fight the guerrilla war alongside the Swamp Fox in a fast-moving hex crawl.
And save the revolution at the climax at Yorktown.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at YourDadWillLoveThis.com. It's time once more to wend our way up the creepity cobweb stairs. I'm going to stop on the landing and wave at the portrait of the fire elemental, but oh, what's he got there? The painting has changed. He's got a chessboard, and it looks like he's winning. We better not play him. Let's head on into the Edwardian parlor where awaits the consulting occultist who, at the behest of beloved Patreon backer Bart Mollio, is going to discuss, as teased in episode 118, so we know who's been going into the back catalog, the magic of chess.
Yeah, I think that this was a tossed-off statement by me of the sort of thing where we had brought up chess in some context, and I said, well, chess is its own magical subject that we could do a whole segment on. And it is its own magical subject. I think it's sort of, you know, you look at chess and you can immediately see that it's got this sort of archetypal legendary quality. You've got kings and queens and knights and bishops and castles. You've got a stylized contest, which is always lovely, played on the black and white board. So there's the duality of good and evil, or yin and yang, going on. So chess itself is a powerful magical symbol or archetype. You don't really need any more excuse than that to start introducing it. But of course, as with everything, once you start looking, you can start breaking it down even more. Chess begins as the game Chaturanga, which is from India. And sure enough, the 8x8 square layout of the board maps to the Vastu Mandala diagram of the world, the cosmos, the ideal house, the human body. It's the diagram. It's what everything maps to. And Vastu is basically Hindi for feng shui. So if you're asking, where is my game application? There we are. Chess is a way to track your feng shui points in a feng shui game. And it is about feng shui. And of course, the Chinese chess literally has a river and two houses in it. So it couldn't be more feng shui based, but we're sticking to regular chess. The 64 squares, each square can be a hexagram of the I Ching, if you're doing chess as divination, which a lot of people do, and we'll get to the best case of that in a bit. The Masonic pavement is a chessboard inside the lodge, black and white squares, and the perimeter of the board, this is something that I did not realize until I did the research for this, is 28 squares. So it's a lunar month. So you can do, you know, astrology with your chessboard if you want to. And on the topic of astrology with your chessboard, the Rosicrucians got busy and figured it out. So the king is the sun. That makes sense. He doesn't move very much. Everything sort of runs around him. The queen is the moon. That's natural. The mate of the king. The knight is Mars because he's aggressive and he's a knight. The bishop is Jupiter. I'm not necessarily sure where they get that, except they say
this tracked really well until halfway through.
Yeah. The bishop moves in triangles. Ergo, Jupiter. And it's like, I'd like to see the paperwork on that. But then that leaves the rook as Saturn, and the pawns are Mercury because they can change. And when they change at the end of the board, they become Venus. That's when they become the queen. So the pawns are Venus and Mercury, and that lets us get away with there being six chess pieces and seven planets. So good for us. The first major Western History of Chess is by the linguist and orientalist Thomas Hyde. And believe me, Robin, I worked very hard to make him a magician and I couldn't do it. He's the only guy in the 17th century who said, no, I'm good. I'm just going to study real stuff. I'm cool.
Yeah. Renaissance man doesn't have to include alchemist. I'm going to spend those points on something else.
On Chinese. And his book is the first Western history of chess, as I said, but he calls it Mandragoras, which is a weird name. Mandrakes, of course, being magical plants that send you to sleep or send you to another dream realm or in other ways do horrendous magic. And so the notion that chess is itself this sort of magical portal to another world is inherent even in the sober-minded Thomas Hyde's book.
Right. So in order for chess to really, really get a cult, people had to invent an occult version of it, Enochian chess.
Right. This is theoretically designed by William Wynne Westcott and MacGregor Mathers, the guys who set up the Golden Dawn, and they may have adapted an earlier chess version from Germany in the 1880s called Rosicrucian chess, but they, you know, did all the hard work and got it nailed down. It's in existence by 1894, which is when Yeats recalls playing it. It's a four-handed chess board. There are teams of two. The board has extra squares that sort of stick off the end where your ranks go. You've got four elemental chess sets, red, yellow, black, and blue, you know, fire, air, earth, and water. And depending on your elemental...
There's a yellow one in the 1890s? Gosh, yeah. How could I use that?
How could I use a yellow chess set that's designed for magical divination and ritual summonings? I don't know. They're lettered in Enochian, so all the boards, the 64 squares are cut in half with little triangles, and each triangle has an Enochian letter in it. So when you move your chess pieces around, you're spelling out things in Enochian. Sometimes there's other versions of that board. They made a bunch of chess boards for this that have tarot cards or some other sort of divinatory jingis on it. The pieces have cool Egyptian names, and Wikipedia will tell you what they are, and that is one quarter of the answer. That is just the black set, but we don't have time for me to go into all of the sets. But in the black set, the king is Osiris, the queen is Isis, the knight is Horus, the bishop is either Aruaris, who is the elder Horus, or Thoth, and the rook is Nephthys or Sekhmet. And those gods move into battle, and then that determines sort of the nature of the divinatory result, or it determines how your ritual goes. And you play chess as both a ritual and as divination.
So can you stroll into an occult bookshop or dial up on the internet and get yourself an Enochian chess set today?
I believe that on the internet you can find the, I know you can find the rules because I did. I am sure that wherever fine chess sets are sold, someone will sell you an Enochian chess set, but I did not look to see what that's going to set you back. And like all magical tools, you should make it yourself. You shouldn't be depending on some, you know, Jamf making it for you.
Right. Speaking of magical tools, Aleister Crowley was chess club president at Cambridge and even thought he might turn pro. And there are various points in his life where he's at loose ends and he heads to a chess club. So it's an interest he kept out throughout his life. And on chessgames.com, you can even go search for his name and see four documented games that he played and someone recorded. So writing down chess games, of course, is a big part of chess. And so this creates the possibility that some sort of code or working could be found in, whether it's Crowley's or somebody else's old game might in fact be, well, why did he lose that way? What was that all about? And in fact, it's an encrypted version of some sort of spell or ritual that you have to uncover.
Exactly. And then you've also found a Dreamhound chess player, just to keep it game-oriented. Yes,
so Marcel Duchamp famously was more interested in chess than he was in surrealist art because he only had to create, you know, a relatively low number of pieces to make his point and become still the most influential visual artist even today. So he's the least occult of all of the surrealists. But in Dreamhounds of Paris, he has access to the Dreamlands, and he's described as searching for the best chess players, not only in the waking world, but in the dream world. So he may be interested in reshaping the Dreamlands as a sort of an intellectual puzzle. So it may come to increasingly resemble, say, other game boards, and then as it's becoming more and more what he wants it to be, it could be the Dreamlands is just turning into a giant chessboard, whether that's has a Lewis Carroll vibe to it or something more sinister. So that's an element of a chess and surrealism that you can bring into your Trail of Cthulhu game.
Yeah, and it is, I think, if you're looking at, you know, chess as initiatory journey, certainly Lewis Carroll is your first stop with Alice in Wonderland. And that's, you know, all chess problems. And Carroll, of course, was a mathematician, so he was into it. If you're looking for the paradigmatic cursed chess set story, that is Midnight by the Morphe Watch by Fritz Leiber from 1974. And it has cool, fun facts about chess masters, all of whom, of course, were crazy, not to put too fine a point on it. And one of the examples that he gives is that Steinmetz, the great, I believe, Czech-American chess champion, by the end of his life, believed that he could move the pieces by electricity from his mind and would challenge God to chess at the odds of pawn and move. And so that is, you know, a fun thing that you can put in, the notion that by playing chess obsessively, you enter into this sort of weird shamanic god realm that messes with you.
Yes, having too much math in your head and making it competitive and high pressure is bad for the brain.
Right. And then in terms of the occult chess, the chess that contains codes or the chess set that has magical power, I think maybe the first of the doorstops to look at is the conspiracy thriller, The Eight, by Catherine Neville, which has, that's from 1988. It has the general flaw of everyone in history is part of this conspiracy, but it's still pretty exciting and chess-based and will give you the vibe that you're looking for, and maybe you adapt it to your own specific conspiracy. And again, you know, anything, once you start thinking of chess sets, can be an 8x8 square grid. So, for example, the downtown of your city, if you live in America, is probably an 8x8 grid. And so, is building buildings on those blocks a chess move? Is, you know, the pattern of lights or the pattern of traffic, is that a chess move? Do you, the vampire lords of your city or the mystical fairy courts that battle over your city, if you live in a sort of an Emma Bull type universe, is there chess being played out on the grid of your street, the iconic grid of whatever your hometown is? And that is, you know, the basis for approximately a million vampire or changeling or other urban fantasy type stories, Dresden Files, whatever you're doing. You don't need much more than that to just pick your favorite 8x8 grid, decide it's a chessboard, and start figuring out how you register magical moves, and then, second of all, how you start making magical moves as, one assumes, unknown armies, characters who want to move up from street level to cosmic, and magical chess becomes a great way to do it, because living chess, as we know, is even more exciting when the pawns have to stab each other to determine who wins.
And of course, if you have miniatures for your characters, and you have a chessboard, you could put them on the board and have any of these sets of movements and peregrinations affect what's going on. You could literally have a fight with flanking rules. You could be have a hallucinatory experience where you're the main chess pieces on one side and you're fighting chess pieces on another side. They might be miniatures representing your antagonists in the world, or you might literally be fighting a king and a bishop and so forth. And, you know, you got to watch out for that queen. She's got the highest stats.
Exactly. She's got the ranged attack. She can move to point blank.
Well, I think once more, Ken, you and I have checkmated the forces of boredom and ignorance and can head on out of this here podcast, but we'll head back in a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pellegrin Press.
ArcDream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Keep this podcast's blood where it belongs by joining such backers as
Svebor Micic,
Christian Grunseth,
Chris Doyle,
Daniel Markwig,
and Jamie Twine.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.